For the past couple of weeks, we've been in the book of Habakkuk. First, we heard the prophet complain to God and ask, "Why is there so much rampant injustice and you do not hear?" Then God responds and says, "I am doing a work in your days that you would not believe if told. I will use the Babylonians for my divine purpose." And today, we are hearing the prophet's second complaint to God in Habakkuk 1, chapter 21 to chapter 2, verse 1. "Are you not from everlasting, O Lord my God, my Holy One? We shall not die. O Lord, you have ordained them as a judgment, and you, O Rock, have established them for reproof. You who are of purer eyes than to see evil and cannot look at wrong, why do you idly look at traitors and remain silent when the wicked swallows up the man more righteous than he? You make mankind like the fish of the sea, like crawling things that have no ruler. He brings all of them up with a hook. He drags them out with his net. He gathers them in his dragnet. So he rejoices and is glad. Therefore, he sacrifices to his net and makes offering to his dragnet. For by them he lives in luxury, and his food is rich. Is he then to keep on emptying his net and mercilessly killing nations forever? I will take my stand at my watchpost and station myself on the tower and look out to see what he will say to me and what I will answer concerning my complaint."
Good morning, everybody. Christianity is an exceedingly simple religion. All that you have to do is believe. Jesus has everything else covered. Christians are not nice, neat people who have it all together. We are the mess, and Jesus cleans us up. Christians are not the heroes of the story. We are the helpless villagers, the damsels in distress, and Jesus rides to our rescue. Christians are not the healers of the world. We are those whose hearts are failing. And Jesus comes to us and lays us on the operating table and does for us what no other surgeon would do or even could do. He takes out his own heart and replaces the failure at the very core of our being with his victory, with his eternal life. That's Christianity. And all we have to do is believe. That's really the whole list. Now, that can sound like a fairy tale. Like Peter Pan, just think happy thoughts and your feet will lift up off the ground into heaven. But not if we realize that in this world, believing is more or less the hardest thing there is. Belief in this life is not second star to the right and straight on till morning. Belief in this life is 3 yards and a cloud of dust. Belief in this land of thistles and weeds is many sorrowed and many struggled before it's ever many splendor. Belief is hard. Habakkuk knows all about this. We're not going to get into the whole situation. Short version, things were bad, and Habakkuk prayed to God and asked for help, and God answered, and then things got much, much worse. How much worse? Verse 15 begins, "He brings them all up with a hook." That's not a metaphor. The Babylonian Empire, when they conquered territory, like they had just conquered Jerusalem, they would enslave much of the population, and they would drive fish hooks through everyone's bottom lip and string them together and force march them through the desert into exile. That's how much worse. Habakkuk knows what it is for belief to be hard. And so, Habakkuk laments. This section that Kay just read for us from chapter 1, verse 12 through the first verse of chapter 2 is Habakkuk's prayer, his attempt to believe when just believing seems more than he can muster. And my hope for us as we work our way through this prayer is that we'll find here a pattern for our own laments, for when belief is hard and we turn to God. And not just a pattern, not just a how-to, although that's certainly there, but the freedom to lament. Because I think often we have the impression that it's not okay to be as sad as we actually are, to have faith as flimsy as ours is. And to find here the strength, the courage to lament. Because lament is a scary business. It can feel like, if we acknowledge out loud how much we are struggling to believe, what little faith we have will disappear. That if we venture out into the piercing cold of our sorrow, we won't ever be warm again. And so I pray that as we go through this prayer, Habakkuk's own lament, we find here both a pattern and a power for us to lament. And we're going to work through the prayer more or less phrase by phrase and structure it around four words that summarize what Habakkuk's doing here. Four words of lament: know, see, ask, and wait. Know, see, ask, and wait. And these will, I hope, guide us in our own prayers, when our prayers can't be that pretty. So, the first word of lament is know. Habakkuk starts with what he knows. It's as if he's gotten lost in the wilderness, and he's trying to get his bearings. So he's reciting to himself, I know at that intersection back there, I turned left. I know that where I'm trying to go is somewhere over that ridge. I know that it's late afternoon and the sun is that way, so west is that way. Except Habakkuk, everything that he knows, all of his fixed points, all of his bearings, are about God. And so he begins in verse 12 to talk about what he knows about God, and he starts with God's eternity. Verse 12 begins, "Are you not from everlasting, O Lord my God, my Holy One?" Habakkuk knows that God is eternal, that he's forever, that he was before this terrible situation he finds himself in, and that God will be after the situation. That unlike every circumstance in this life, unlike the Babylonian captivity, unlike a groaning and struggling environment, unlike fractured families, unlike whatever it is that makes you most anxious, whatever gnaws and nibbles at the edges of your consciousness, God is eternal. All of those other things will come and go. They are bound in time in a way that God is not. And Habakkuk knows this and starts with what he knows. He knows God's eternity and he knows God's promise. The next thing he says doesn't make a ton of sense, considering that he's speaking in the aftermath of a war that his people lost. In the midst of a conquered land, Habakkuk says, "We shall not die." It is very likely that there are corpses in his view. And Habakkuk says, "We shall not die." Of course, he doesn't mean that no one's heart will stop beating. He means that we, God's people, as God's people, will not perish. Somehow, the story ends well. And the reason that he can say that, the reason he knows that, is because of what he just said. Did you notice right before that he did not refer to God as the Holy One, but my Holy One? Isn't that a little presumptuous? I mean, if God is eternal and infinite and from everlasting and high and lifted up and holy, how can he belong to someone? Surely only in the sense that a pet owner belongs to a pet. Your dog has a claim on you if you have a dog, if and only if you first claimed the dog. That's the foundation of the relationship. And God has claimed us as his people. Even though we are far less than him, as a dog is to a human, because he has chosen us and committed himself to us, we are more than just his property. God has promised to work for our good, to stay in a relationship with us. So somehow the story ends well. Every story, and the story of God's people is no exception, has times where a happy ending looks impossible, where redemption seems absolutely beyond hope. From time to time, you have or you will find yourself trapped in the jaws of a moment like that. Maybe today is such a time. But God has promised that somehow, at some point, he will rescue you from the mouth of death and despair and lead you into eternal life. He has promised the story ends well, and God keeps his promises. Habakkuk knows this. Habakkuk also knows God's sovereignty. God's sovereignty means God's in-chargeness, that God is in control. He says in the rest of verse 12, O Lord, you have ordained them as a judgment, and you, O rock, have established them for reproof. Them refers to Babylon, to this great and vicious empire that has just conquered God's people, that seems like a hurricane, like this restless, uncontainable, boundless evil. But Habakkuk knows that God is sovereign, which means that the entire Babylonian empire rests in the palm of God's hand, that God put them there and he can sweep them away whenever he so chooses. Habakkuk knows that God is sovereign. Now, it is hard to believe that God is sovereign over that kind of massive evil. That is not a straightforward thing. My uncle, Bruce, is a forester. He's responsible for the welfare of these big swaths of timberland in eastern North Carolina. And one of the ways that he keeps those forests healthy is with controlled burns. So the undergrowth will start to build up in the forest, and if it grows enough, not only is it sapping the soil of nutrients that the other more mature plants can take advantage of, but at some point a fire will start, and if there's enough undergrowth, it'll burn hot enough and high enough to destroy the mature trees as well. And so he and other foresters will recognize that and come in and start a fire on purpose that sweeps through, clears out the undergrowth, converts those bushes and brambles into food in the soil, and prevents a more destructive fire. And God is using Babylon exactly like that, to sweep away the sinful and distracting junk that is accumulated in and around his people, to purge them and make it possible for them to grow. God does this, which leaves me wondering how we will respond when God executes a controlled burn of the American church, of Calvin, of our individual lives. I can't tell you how he will do such a thing or when. I can't even tell you exactly why, what his purposes will be, but I promise you it will happen. In that kind of fire, it's the deep-rooted things that survive and even thrive in the aftermath, whereas those things that cling to the surface are swept away. So I have to wonder what we are doing to lay down deep roots, to be ready so that in the midst of the blaze, when belief is at its hardest, we still point what little belief we can muster toward God, where it belongs. Do we know that God is sovereign? Habakkuk does, and he knows God's character. First part of verse 13. You who are of purer eyes than to see evil and cannot look at wrong. Obviously, God sees evil. Habakkuk is not talking about, you know, God goes into the movie theater and averts his eyes once he realizes it's rated R. That's not what's going on. He's saying that God is of such purity that he cannot see evil and do nothing. He can't sit by and watch the class bully work his will. God doesn't do indifference. He sees every bit of wickedness. The blood of every oppressed and wrong person cries out to him from the ground. And he intends to do something about it. That's God's character. He will not sit on his hands. These are the things that Habakkuk knows: God's eternity and his promise and his sovereignty and his character. And Habakkuk begins his prayer with them because even though he knows them to be true, it is hard to believe them. He's reminding himself of what he knows. He understands that in the midst of the storm, unless he turns again and again to God, to what he knows to be true about God as his North Star, he will get totally turned around and swept up in the raging sea. Begin your prayers this way, especially when belief is hard, especially when things like this don't feel true. Remind yourself that they are true. This is not magic. It won't cause your problems to suddenly disappear, but there is so much difference between a prayer that begins, God, how am I ever going to pay all of these bills? And a prayer that begins, God, you have always provided for me. And you have promised to provide for me. I have no idea how I'm going to pay these bills. Help. Those are not the same. And the second one will help you believe when belief is hard. Start with what you know. That's where Habakkuk starts. And he really has to start there because then he moves on to what he sees. And what he sees is not encouraging. Picking it up in the second half of verse 13. Why do you idly look at traitors and remain silent when the wicked swallows up the man more righteous than he? You make mankind like the fish of the sea, like crawling things that have no ruler. He brings all of them up with a hook. He drags them out with his net. He gathers them with his dragnet. So he rejoices and is glad. Therefore he sacrifices to his net and makes offerings to his dragnet, for by them he lives in luxury and his food is rich. Habakkuk starts to see. See is the second word of lament. And when Habakkuk looks around, when he sees, what he sees is evil reigning. The wicked swallows up the man more righteous than he. Nice guys finishing last is not a new thing. It's been going on a long, long time. A lot of places in a lot of ways. What Habakkuk sees is humanity degrading itself. Back in verse 14, you make mankind like the fish of the sea, like crawling things that have no ruler. That's Habakkuk's praying in direct contrast to what God has said humanity is supposed to be. In texts like Genesis 1 and Psalm 8, God's been very clear. Humanity, we're supposed to be those rulers. the ones who govern the fish and the crawling things and every other part of creation so that all might flourish. And Habakkuk looks out and he sees humanity stepping down from that role, abdicating that responsibility to become like the beasts. He sees us degrading ourselves. When the slave owner cracks the whip, he degrades the person whose back he strikes, treats them like cattle. He also degrades himself, refusing the mantle of servant leadership and becoming nothing more than an angry territorial predator. When the young man pulls up an illicit video on his phone, he certainly degrades the actress in the video, treats her as a mere object. He also degrades himself, gives power to the lie that he is a mere animal who can be satisfied by mere animal desires. Habakkuk looks around, and this is what he sees. Evil reigning, humanity degrading itself, and people worshiping the things that seem to give them power. Verse 16, therefore he sacrifices to his net and makes offerings to his dragnet, for by them he lives in luxury and his food is rich. This was the way of the world. Babylon's empire depended on a model of constant conquest. In order to sustain the building projects and the luxury for the upper class and the massive armies, they had to always be conquering new territory so that they could rape the land and subjugate the people as slave labor. They were very much like a fire that as soon as it consumes something, burns hotter and brighter and needs even more things to consume. And so Babylon worshipped the tools that brought them more fuel. Horse and chariot, sword and spear, a brutal, callous, martial mentality. And not only they, but often the people they conquered. This is why Israel, God's people, was so often tempted to worship the same things as the nations around them. Because it really did lead to more power. It really did lead to more luxury and richer food. Habakkuk looks around and he sees this. And it's our challenge to do the same, to see the world as it is, but to do more than that, to see through what there is and realize that that's not all there is, that what we perceive around us is not the entire story. Habakkuk does this. He sees humanity behaving like the fish of the sea, swimming to and fro in a big school, just going where the crowd is going. But he doesn't jump in. He has to step back to observe that and to call it out, to believe, which is a hard thing to do. It is always going to be easier for us when we look around and see the way the world is, it's going to be easier to go that way, to see that education really does lead to a more comfortable life, and so to put our belief in SAT prep programs and advanced degrees. Not that those things are bad, but to believe as if they will solve all of our problems, to make offerings to them and sacrifice our lives to them. It's always going to be easier to look around and see that the people who have the most representatives and the most votes get what they want in terms of laws. And so to throw ourselves into signing petitions and voting and exercising political power, not that that is a bad thing to do at all, but to take it from a good thing to the thing we worship, the thing that will make everything okay, that gives us power, it's always going to be easier to do that. What's hard, it is to see past those realities to the greater reality, which is that God and God alone is from everlasting. And so God and God alone is the one who gives lasting power. Those other things, however good they might be, will operate like a fire within us, demanding more and more fuel, consuming our lives moment by moment until there's nothing left. And one way or another, we have degraded ourselves. Only God offers power to reach beyond that. Can we see what there is and see through what there is to the God who made it all? You might ask in response, how am I supposed to do that? If I grant that I am supposed to, what's the method? And that's a long, complicated question. I'll get you started. Unlearn blindness and be specific. An enormous part of seeing is unlearning what you already, without intending to, have become a master at, which is not seeing. All of us have developed a whole skill set around avoiding truths that we don't want to see. We become too busy and distracted, whether that's because the calendar is full of important appointments or the phone is full of too many apps, to see the needs and the sorrow around us. Or we've become masterfully defensive at avoiding seeing the evil and self-degradation within us. And if you are going to learn to see, you're going to have to start by acknowledging that you have made yourself blind and begin to peel off the scales that you have put over your eyes. Learning to see means unlearning blindness. It also means being specific. There's a lot of sorrow in the world, a lot of sin and brokenness to go around. And you are meant to see on a human scale, which means less trying to sort out how we can put an end to mental illness and more loving your neighbor who has bipolar disorder. It means less trying to become an expert on what would be the best national family policy and more spending time with the people you know whose marriage is falling. Be specific. See on a human scale. You can't know the entire Pacific Ocean. But if you were to go again and again over to Newport and camp at South Beach, you could come to know that little strip of sand and that pattern of waves quite well. Unlearn blindness and be specific. The second word of lament is see. The third word is ask. And it follows, I think, necessarily from the first two. If you know God, if you know something of who he is, what power and character are his, and then you look around and see the way the world is, how can you not ask, what's going on here? And that's exactly what Habakkuk does in verse 17. Is he then to keep on emptying his net and mercilessly killing nations forever? He is still Babylon, and Habakkuk is wondering, is this just the way it goes for the rest of history? They move on to the next place and the next place and the next place. They destroy the next city and enslave the next people. This is the classic question of lament. How long? How long are you going to let this go on? We all can grasp the purpose of limited suffering, yes? We don't even think twice about inflicting limited suffering on ourselves. So much of what constitutes good and legitimate healthcare is self-inflicted limited suffering, right? From the preventative stuff like diet and exercise all the way up to chemotherapy. That's what you're doing in healthcare. And we understand that rightly to be a good thing. But that's because we can see and even control the limits. What happens when the limits are beyond us? We don't know where they are or even if they exist. What happens when we are suffering, when we see suffering, and we don't know the end? The end date, the time when it stops, or the end point, the purpose to which it is supposed to be building? Then we have to ask, how long? Brian Stevenson is an attorney who works primarily with clients who are on death row, and one of his first cases was with a man named Walter McMillan. And he took the case to file an appeal for Mr. McMillan. But before he did that or set foot in a courtroom, he got a strange phone call from Justice Robert E. Lee Key. No, I'm not making the name up. Judge Key did everything short of ordering Mr. Stevenson to drop the case. He was adamant that Walter McMillan did not deserve a defense, that he was guilty of sin and needed to fry. You should know that Mr. McMillan was innocent and that the facts always pointed to his innocence. It was never about that. It was about the fact that Walter McMillan was black and from South Alabama and no friend of the police, and that a little white girl in that town was brutally murdered. And so he sat on death row. In the face of that, how do we not ask, how long? Not just how long until Walter gets off, how long until the judge gets judged? How long does he get to wear a robe and swing a gavel? I'd contend that this question lurks in the back of all of our minds anyway. It's just that lament has the courage to say it out loud and to say it to the person who's ultimately responsible for the world. How long? How much more? How many more funerals? How many more orphans? How many refugees left to live in a tent in the desert? How many more terrorists who claim to believe in God but clearly believe more in bullets and bombs? How many more powerful men who will offer a young lady a helping hand if... What could possibly make this worth it? Oh God, surely you know. How long until you let the rest of us in on the secret? How long? Go ahead and ask the question. God is not afraid of the question. And he will not be angry with you for asking. Go ahead and know and see. Go ahead and ask it out loud. That's the third word of lament, is ask. The fourth word of lament, and the place that we find ourselves so often, whether we want to be there or not, is wait. Having known and seen and asked, we wait. This is what Habakkuk sets out to do at the beginning of chapter 2. I will take my stand at my watchpost and station myself on the tower and look out to see what he will say to me and what I will answer concerning my complaint. Having known and seen and asked, Habakkuk sets out to wait. He takes the posture of one who is looking Godward and awaiting a response. And to his credit, Habakkuk knows the business he's getting into. He knows that God is from everlasting, that to God 1,000 years is but one watch in the night. He doesn't say, I'll be here for 5 minutes or 5 days or even 5 years. He sets out to wait as long as it takes. Habakkuk knows. He knows God's promises and he knows that God always keeps his promises, but he's also somewhat familiar with the way that God keeps his promises. He knows that God promised this man named Abraham to give him the land of Canaan. And then 500 years later, when Abraham's bones were dissolving underground, God gave his family the land of Canaan. Habakkuk has a sense of what it means to wait on God. That this is, in all likelihood, a lifelong endeavor. For him and for us. I hate waiting. Even the 5 minutes, I hate waiting. I'm maniacally punctual because it's hard for me to imagine anything worse than waiting. So I don't want to inflict that on anyone else. And yet this is what God gives us to do. I want to be clear, it's not all that God gives us to do. Waiting on God is not a passive thing where we just sort of sit back. Mr. Stevenson won that appeal and was there the day Walter McMillan walked out of prison. But he is not naive enough, nor should we be, as to believe that we will put an end to prejudice by our own effort or ingenuity. We live in the midst of the night, and we make war on the darkness. We know that it's only the dawn that will put an end to the black, and that we can't make the sunrise. We can take our stand at our watchpost and look east. We can wait on God. That's what we're meant to do. Know and see and ask and wait. It's not a happy syllabus. It doesn't sound like a hopeful one either. Habakkuk died waiting. He died looking to see how God would respond concerning his complaint. This kind of time, God didn't take 500 years. He took more than 600. Left Habakkuk standing on that wall indefinitely. But then one day, people standing on the walls of Jerusalem saw God's answer. They saw a man riding down a road from the east on a donkey, and crowds attending him and singing Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. God's people waited a long, long time for God to fulfill his promise. But he did. He sent his son, Jesus. Jesus was, and Jesus is, and Jesus always will be God's answer concerning Habakkuk's complaint. Jesus was and is and always will be God's answer concerning all of our legitimate complaints. I still hate waiting. And we will probably be waiting a long time. God's people waited an awfully long time to see Jesus for the first time. And now we wait to see him again. And it is a long, messy business. I don't know when the wait will be over, and neither does anyone else walking the face of the earth. But I know this. Not only is God from everlasting, not only is God sovereign, God is just. God is so just, his commitment to justice runs so deep that in order to see justice for the oppressed, Jesus joined them. He came to Jerusalem to go under the thumb of tyrants. to be the only totally innocent defendant in the history of the world. And God is so just, his commitment to justice runs so deep that in order to see justice for the oppressors, in order to make sure that the unrighteous judge will finally be judged, Jesus took the greatest blow they had to give, let himself be crushed on their cross so that he could crush death, their final weapon, under his feet when he walked out of the grave. We wait a long time, but we wait on a just God. So know that. And in knowing that, find the courage to look around and see just how unjust the world still is. Just how unjust you still are. And direct your question to the person who has an answer. To the person who is the answer. And wait on him. We are God's people. That doesn't mean we understand everything about him or everything that he's doing in the world. It doesn't mean that we never wander or we never get disheartened. Being God's people means that we believe, even when believing is hard, that Jesus is worth waiting for. Being God's people means that we consider that the sufferings of this present time, however staggering they are not worth comparing to the glory Jesus will one day reveal to us. Being God's people means that we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now. It means that not only that, but we also groan inwardly while we wait for our adoption as sons and daughters, for the redemption of our bodies. Being God's people means that in this hope, in the hope of Jesus, we are saved. Doesn't mean we see it yet. No one hopes for what they see, because then it wouldn't be hope. Being God's people means we wait for it. We wait for it because of what we know, sometimes in spite of what we see. Being God's people means we wait for it with patience. The Bible is packed full of models of this kind of waiting and lamenting prayer. And so rather than making up my own words to close the sermon in prayer, I'm going to read two psalms of waiting lament over you. These are Psalms 62 and 130. For God alone, my soul waits in silence. From him comes my salvation. He alone is my rock and my salvation, my fortress. I will not be shaken. How long will all of you attack a man to batter him like a leaning wall, like a tottering fence? They only plan to thrust him down from his high position. They take pleasure in falsehood. They bless with their mouths, but inwardly they curse. For God alone, O my soul, wait in silence, for my hope is from him. He only is my rock and my salvation, my fortress. I shall not be greatly shaken. On God rests my salvation and my glory, my mighty rock, my refuge is God. Trust in him at all times, O people. Pour out your heart before him. God is a refuge for us. Those of low estate are but a breath, and those of high estate are a delusion. In the balances, they go up. They are together lighter than a breath. Put no trust in extortion. Set no hope in vain robbery. If riches increase, set not your heart on them. Once God has spoken, twice have I heard this, that power belongs to God, and that to you, O Lord, belongs steadfast love, for you will render to a man according to his work. Out of the depths I cry to you, O Lord. O Lord, hear my voice. Let your ears be attentive to the voice of my pleas for mercy. If you, O Lord, should mark iniquities, O Lord, who could stand? But with you there is forgiveness, that you may be feared. I wait for the Lord. My soul waits for the Lord, and in his word I hope. My soul waits for the Lord more than watchmen for the morning. More than watchmen for the morning. O Israel, hope in the Lord, for with the Lord there is steadfast love, and with him there is plentiful redemption. And he will redeem Israel from all their iniquities. Thank you, Father, that you are worth waiting for, that you really will redeem us, that justice is with you, and all we have to do is believe. Give us strength, even for that.